down. I'm expecting all hell to break loose. People are crazy and time's strange. Locked inside, I'm out of range. I used to care. Things are changed. Should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy, it's time to strain. I'm locked in tight, my brain. I used to care, but things have changed. Walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Some days are too hard to touch. The human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first woman I meet. Putting her in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Just don't show it. You can hurt someone and not even know it. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. I'm in love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager to make that mistake. Some people are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today's date is the 30th of April, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned into Liberty Tree Radio. I'd like to say thanks for taking the time to tune in today. I hope this is beneficial to you. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. And the first two words seem to be kind of difficult, so I'll spell them phonetically. Alpha, Lima, Tango, Hotel, Alpha, Bravo, Echo, Bravo, 762@hotmail.com. Sending this one out to Lily Grace Antoinette. And today, I'd mentioned it last week, go ahead and we've opened up the telephone, take calls. The telephone number is 712-432-0900. 712-432-0900. The mechanical voice comes on, ask for the room, and that would be 957-464, and the pound sign, 957-464, and the pound sign. And you'll be muted, and then to come up, then just push *6, and that'll unmute you, and say your piece, and then you can mute yourself by pushing *6 again. So the telephone is 712-432-0900. The room number is 957-464 and the pound sign. And then to come up on the air, you can hit the *6 button. We've been discussing the issues of kind of laying out the parts and pieces of insurgency and explaining the war of the flea that somehow it's addressed as. And I'd kind of like to set that off to the side because there's a possibility it could be some confusion on what I talk about when I use the word insurgency. We'll get that. I picked up a book the other day at the library, and it's called The Road Not Taken by Max Boot. And I don't know, I bet you it's 300 or 400 pages long. It has a lot to do with a person named Edward Lansdale. And we'll get on with that. I've only read about 100 pages of it. There were some parts and pieces at the beginning. It starts off with the coup against Diem, the president of Vietnam, in the early 1960s. And then it kind of goes back to the lineage of Edward Lansdale, his mother, father, grandfather, children, all that part, how he was raised and where he had come up with his ideas. But today I really want to get to the insurgency part, and it's going to take, about a good 45 minutes to try to explain these things. And again, we're taking the calls, and I think the website is libertytreeradio.4mg.com, has the telephone number on there in case you didn't get it. And we'll just kind of go from there. And most likely we'll continue with these open phones for as long as necessary. I also have quite a few deals about border news, and I have Bob Miner's telephone number and address to contact him. As insurgency war, it must first be strategically and tactically understood before it can be effectively countered. The enemy must first be seen before he can be fought, and one must be able to accurately plan before you can train. Now, as an antidote to the various misconceptions he saw developing in the mid-1960s, Sir Robert Granger Kerr Thompson, he observed that in spite of the grand, eloquent, and misleading titles, an insurgency is not a people's revolutionary war. and he cited the government intelligence figures. And Thompson indicates by 1965, the number of insurgents and their supporters active in South Vietnam never exceeded 1% of the total population. And with that in mind, he concluded that the insurgency was not qualified to be a people's revolutionary war, but only a revolutionary form of warfare designed to enable a very small, ruthless minority to gain control over the people. And Robert Thompson's practical views about insurgency warfare, particularly from that period, remains some of the most definitive. Now, Thompson refrains from mixing terminology, and he does not provide a specific definition of insurgency war, but his illustrations of insurgency tendencies and peculiarities are better to explain an important strategic concept that otherwise appears useless. So a first objective must then be to reach a more precise understanding of insurgency without confusing terminology. And from this, and in the modern spirit of insurge, I-N-S-U-R-G-E-R-E, it's a Latin word, and in the participle it means to rise up. So we'll come up with a working definition and explanation of insurgency war. So insurgency is a political military conflict waged against a specific faction, implementing irregular military actions in support of a unified political outcome short of revolution and civil war. Now, while regular military forces may be employed, irregular operations rooted in political subversion, selective terrorism, and guerrilla operations play an integral, if not primary, role in the outcome. A political subversion, selective terrorism, and guerrilla operations are then tactics that, when combined, may or may not represent the insurgency, because insurgency is a strategic political development that implements those tactics as a means to sustain itself until further development can occur. So consequently, an insurgency as a type of war may lead to and be part of a larger conventional conflict, revolution or civil war. An insurgency as a method of war implies the attempt to use violence and irregular forms of warfare against a particular faction for the express purpose of political military gain, which may later lead to inclusion with or the overthrow of the existing regimes. Now, the object of insurgency is to force a political social upheaval in an organized fashion for the express purpose of validating a cause and therefore justifying its violent means. Now, insurgencies do not have the capacity to be a revolution or a civil war, but with staying power and continued support can ignite either. So therefore, an insurgency is neither revolution nor civil war, and as well, the three major elements identified as tools used in insurgency, the political subversion, the selective terrorism, and the guerrilla operations. Now, any other aspect, political or military, that might be attributed to an insurgency will likely fall under one of these three major tactical elements. Now, Thompson has stated with consistency that the first phase of an insurgency always begins with subversive activity. And he goes so far as to state that insurgency is a measure both of the success and of the failure of subversion. Because if the subversion is successful enough to continue the insurgency, but not successful enough to achieve the objective by subversion alone, then the insurgency moves to a second phase, open insurgency or armed struggle. The second phase consists of the use of guerrilla operations combined with terrorist activities will typically result in a protracted struggle. When Thompson spoke about insurgency, he was speaking directly about communist insurgency and thus communist subversion. Now, from his experiences, both war and politics in Malaya and Vietnam, one might believe that he was led to this understanding for obvious reasons, and not unlike many others of the time, Thompson believed that insurgency was a unique tool of the top communist and therefore fashioned to a unique communist design. But the working definition that we provided does not perceive insurgency as being of any particular origin, nor specifically fashioned out of any political dogma. Insurgencies possess certain universal qualities that set it apart as a separate strategic concept from revolution and civil war. While revolution is non-indigenous and civil war is indigenous, insurgencies can be either. So while political subversion, selective terrorism, and guerrilla operations are all key elements in an insurgency, the political subversion is unquestionably the one element that must exist for the other two elements to have any unified effect. And the extent of the political organization of the subversives will likely predict how competent and effective the entire insurgency will turn out to be. Now, the heart of an insurgency is the political capability of the subversives, the quality of their organization, and the extent of the roots that they set down. To establish a valid insurgency, the subversive organization must acquire the necessary resources and support from both internal and external factions. And just how well the support is managed is going to determine whether a second phase will be required or is even possible. And the political subversion attempts to accomplish four specific things. First, to build and test the political infrastructure needed to wage a successful insurgency. Second, to generate political clout, both internal and external. And third, to support a second phase of open insurgency. And fourth, if it intends to go beyond insurgency war, to plan for government after revolution or civil war is achieved. And those insurgencies resulting in either revolution or civil war represent some of the most skilled and resourceful political organizations. And those groups will not appear fanatical in their actions, only ardent in their resolve. Now, while such intent seems revolutionary to outsiders, it is purely evolutionary to the insurgents. And it's this outlook which provide the potential for success and is the catalyst for growth. Now, the crossover to violence is accomplished during the early stages of an insurgency by the use of terrorism. And this is the heavy-handed persuasion used by the political subversives as a means of drawing closer attention to their cause. And when truly selective, it is capable of removing strategic targets that prove to be capable of removing an obstruction. Now, indiscriminate terrorism has never been a friend of an insurgency movement, but when it's implemented correctly and with precision, the results usually favor the subversive political body. Thompson indicates that even in a pre-insurgency time of murder and terrorism, the normal process of law and order will fail to cope with the situation. The police are unable to effect arrest because of a lack of witnesses, or the crime itself might not even be reported. And a strong history and willingness on the part of the subversives to perform vendetta and reprisal killings typically silences the majority of the population. Now, if the government is internally crippled or substantially unsupported and weak, the insurgency will not need to progress to the second phase. The government of that hobbled nature is going to succumb to the insurgent pressure. And it's important to note here that this does not qualify the insurgency as revolution. Now, while an insurgency may usurp authority if the government falls, assumption of responsibility may not have been the actual intent of the original subversion. The insurgents may get hold of the government reins before they're actually willing or even capable of successful governing. And these subversives will usually weaken and fall to other factions, and then a potential merry-go-round of insurgencies can exist under such a state. And since the object of the insurgency is not necessarily the establishment of a new state, the ousting of either external colonial factions or internal civil antagonists, the attempt must be for the subversives to strengthen their cause, and that's done through the use of guerrilla operations in the second phase. Now, during this period, the selective terrorism activities may heighten, and political subversives will continue to expand their control in the populated areas where support will strengthen the guerrilla operations. Because the insurgents expect a protracted struggle, a careful search for base areas is undertaken. Two types of the base areas exist, one controlled by the guerrillas, the other by the political subversives. Now, the first is what's referred to sometimes as the jungle base area, and that provides the guerrillas with sanctuary, supplies, and war material, in essence a logistical base for military support. Now, the other base of support comes from the population, and it's controlled by the insurgent political organizations and its terrorist arm. The purpose of the base areas is to sustain recruiting efforts and the supply lines for the duration of the protracted struggle. Now, the insurgent political strength in the rural settings comes from the links maintained with organized cells previously established in large cities and towns. Now, the rural form of the operations may be more desirable, and another form of insurgency may establish and maintain organized cells within the urban population centers. Now, that type of insurgent operation is seen less frequently because of the inherent dangers placed upon the movement, concentrations, and communications between the subversive cells. And no insurgency can successfully grow beyond phase one if it remains solely within an urban environment. Now, two specific functions are performed by the subversive insurgent cell. First, they must maintain a continual flow of propaganda, often supported by terrorist activity, and that would typically include the assassination of formidable political figures who might turn elements of the population against the insurgency. And the second function is to keep the guerrillas supplied with war material and technical support not available in the rural settings, and perhaps most importantly, intelligence information about government plans, movements, and strength. Now, during the subversive phase, much of the planting of the base areas is accomplished, and finding insurgent base areas then becomes a game that the government forces feel obliged to play during the first phase. For the insurgents, success during the second phase depends on how harmoniously its guerrilla operations and its political organization work together. And if thorough planning was done by the insurgents, the governments may be in for an unwelcome protracted struggle. On the second phase, the guerrilla operation has two stages. During the initial stage, the guerrilla units begin operating in conjunction with the terrorist units, both in the rural and the urban settings. And the guerrilla operations in the first stage are diversionary and are employed in consort with the terrorist activities in and around the government army centers. And often the government confuses the actions of the insurgent terrorists with the guerrilla forces during the period. When the guerrilla units begin operations on their own in the second stage, they direct their operations specifically at military targets of opportunity. And this excludes activity that can be perpetrated by the terrorist units, particularly assassinations and the bombing of civilian targets. The guerrilla forces at the second stage are usually engaged in the kind of warfare that they perform best, tactics which include hit and run, search and destroy, and ambush patrols against the government army units. Our strategy on the part of the insurgent guerrilla forces becomes evident during this stage. Its intent to exploit the rural villages in a manner that allows them to encircle the cities, its supporters serving the singular purpose of rendering an as yet undefeated army grounded in in its urban power base, powerless to save the country. And the growing loss of confidence about the government will rise amongst the people, and the destructive but ineffective military, a surge in inflation and economic disturbances, and overall inability to gain external assistance for the internal problems, and an inability to provide capable future governing are all failures that the subversive insurgents hope the common people will begin to perceive as being irreversible within the current government. The next aspect is the primary and the secondary insurgency. Now, during the later stages of the guerrilla operations, the type of insurgency being conducted against the government can easily be identified. The insurgents must make a decision to follow either a primary or a secondary course of strategy. A primary insurgency seeks a military victory by maintaining pressure through guerrilla operations but avoiding any major set-piece battle with the government forces. And the intent is to wear down the government forces through a protracted conflict that relies upon isolated fights at the guerrilla's own choice of place and time. And by keeping the initiative away from the government for an extended period, the hope is that demoralization will establish itself amongst the government officials. With no feasible way to win a decisive victory, the government, it's expected, will negotiate a ceasefire with the insurgent forces, accepting a neutralist solution as a means of winning the war. Now, the secondary insurgency seeks victory by way of changing from isolated or purely guerrilla operations to what Mao Zedong refers to as a war of movement, with the government forces typically spread throughout the rural setting in a defensive posture. The insurgent force are able to occupy and move freely amongst the villages, their direct line of support and communications with the political subversive elements. And then all insurgent forces spearheaded by the guerrilla operations, which then take on a conventional military restructuring, unite and concentrate the entire effort on one or a series of government targets. And the shock effect, combined with thorough planning and military competence, is expected to send the government forces reeling in a continuous state of defense, retreat, and then surrender. Now, unlike the primary insurgency, the secondary strategy looks for the set-piece engagement with the government forces, believing that a decisive, more conventional blow can achieve the desired success in a shorter period of time. And the transition into the secondary insurgency is not an easy or readily apparent move for the subversive strategists. And pinpointing the exact moment a subversive movement should progress into a secondary phase is perhaps the most difficult part of the transition. And choosing the wrong moment or being poorly prepared could bring disaster. And Mao warned of something called guerrillaism, and that's an overlong attachment to the irregular methods, and the successful insurgent leaders realize that undue delay in making that decisive blow can exhaust the popular base of support, therefore extending unnecessarily the guerrilla phase. So now we come to the question about insurgency versus counterinsurgency. Now, if it were always true that any government with the best intentions of the people in mind was sure to triumph over the insurgent movement, there would be no need to understand the differences between insurgency and countering insurgency. But as Thompson points out, there's a real problem with the very use of the term counterinsurgency. He says, quote, "Anyone having any responsibility for dealing with an insurgent movement must know his enemy and what that enemy is attempting to do at all stages. And this does not mean that those responsible should be solely concerned with countering the enemy's moves. I dislike for this reason the very term counterinsurgency. It implies that the insurgents have the initiative and that it is the government's role merely to react and counter that initiative," end quote. Now, during the subversive phase, signs of the insurgency are not always recognizable to a government, and when the problem becomes evident, the people may be slow to arouse, the government forces may react inappropriately, and in that instance, the government runs the risk of either acting too soon, appearing repressive because the subversion is little recognized, or acting too late. And although much evidence about the subversion is apparent in the late reaction, the government is already in the second phase or open insurgency of guerrilla war. So the trick for any government then is to recognize an insurgency during the subversive phase, which will require the least of the military solution. So the best counter to any insurgency can be only another insurgency. Now, the idea of countering anything conjures up reactionary views, and it's best to dispense with the confusion of the term counterinsurgency altogether. Now, Thompson relates five basic principles from which all government measures must evolve. Number one, the government must have a clear political aim to establish and maintain a free, independent, and united country which is politically and economically stable and viable. Number two, the government must function in accordance with the law. Three, the government must have an overall plan. Number four, the government must give priority to defeating the political subversives, not the guerrillas. And number five, in the guerrilla phase of the insurgency, a government must secure its base areas first. And there exists no better set of commandments for any government faced with waging an insurgency. And the same commandments could be intended for the subversive insurgents. Simply replace government with the term subversive, and one has the same equation. Now, what exists in the end is nothing more than the tried and true military theory, maintaining the best intentions of Jomini and Clausewitz. When we get back, we'll get on with our study here. We'll be right back. Well, it's no fun being an illegal alien. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 30th of April, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. My email address is althabeb762@hotmail.com. And as usual, we send this one out to Lily Grace Antoinette. Of the first 30-minute block of today's instruction had to do with, we covered a little bit of the administrative side of it, parts and pieces, public service announcements kind of thing. We also here were discussing what insurgency is and what it is not. Now, where we left off, because we distilling it down to what exists in the end is nothing more than the tried and true military theory, maintaining the best of intentions of Jomini and Clausewitz. And it's basically who can get there first with the most, who has the best intelligence gathering apparatus, who has the better strategy, resources, and manpower, and who has the support of the people. Now, there are several strategic considerations for a government regarding the balance of force during an insurgency, and these include the insurgent organization, the size, and the potential base for a popular support, and the logistic difficulties. And it's likely that all of those elements will be directly affected by the terrain and the disbursement of the population. It's typical that the more rural and dense the terrain, the more sheltered the insurgent forces are. And then a successful phase two, sheltering must then take shape outside the urban centers. And in speaking about open insurgency or phase two of an insurgency, Thompson discusses three specific geographic areas in which the insurgent activity takes place. There are first the populated areas within major cities and towns under the government control where the terrorist activity is the most prevalent. Then there are the rural populated areas where control is disputed between the government and the insurgents and where the guerrilla insurgent forces extend their operations. Finally, there is the more remote, deep jungle bases of the insurgent guerrillas, the less populated terrain, which is also difficult to traverse. And it's here that the guerrillas place their logistical base where they rest, rearm, and plan future operations. What is usually the most difficult for the government forces to quell are the combined subversive terrorist and guerrilla operations that are within the middle geographic area of the rural populated setting. The great tactical error that the governments can make is to assigning priority to those geographic areas. Often the government concentrates on the outside and works in instead of working from the inside out, because the remote guerrilla base areas on the outside are not the source of the insurgent problem and should not be the prime consideration for the government forces in the beginning of an insurgency, because the political subversion provides the impetus. It is the subversives that must be stopped. And at the beginning of an insurgency, and at some time before the subversive element chooses to instigate a second phase of operation, the military, most likely of some regular conventional structure, must be restructured almost wholesale. Now, while some conventional force structure must remain in place to thwart a possible secondary insurgency, substantial training must be done to establish small unit irregulars that can carry on guerrilla tactics themselves. And the strategic and tactical means at hand must not be put towards a military solution, because for a government countering an insurgency, it is the political infrastructure of the insurgents that must be defeated first and last. And such a strategy is so critical because Thompson cautions that even if an armed insurgency is defeated, the political and subversive struggle will go on and can still win. Now, so we ask, can guerrilla tactics be employed successfully against guerrillas? The answer is negative. And to suppose otherwise is to fall into the methods fallacy. Indian fighters do not become Indians by taking scalps. A spotted jungle suit does not make a United States Marine a guerrilla. the experiences of World War II and for every conflict then has made it clear that commando troops are not guerrillas, nor can they so-called counterinsurgency forces now being deployed in a more sophisticated school be considered guerrillas, although they may employ some of the more obvious techniques of the guerrilla fighter, the night raid, the ambush, the roving patrol far from the military base, and so on, because such techniques are as old as warfare itself. It's possible to conceive of their use by Cro-Magnon man against the last of the Neanderthals. They were employed by the Aboriginal Britons against Caesar's legionaries, and they are the techniques of savages in the Colombian jungle, and no doubt of the few surviving New Guinean headhunters to this day. Headhunters are not the guerrillas. The distinction is simple enough, because when we speak of guerrilla fighters, we are speaking of political partisans, an armed civilian whose principal weapon is not his rifle or his machete, but his relationship to the community, the nation, in and for which he fights. Insurgency or guerrilla war is the agency of radical social or political change. It's the face and the right arm of revolution, and counterinsurgency is a form of counter-revolution and the process by which revolution is resisted. And the two are opposite sides of the coin, and it will not do to confuse them or their agents despite superficial similarities. So, that's that. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Now, I have quite an extensive list of a bibliography and resources of where I've collected this information from. The Art of Insurgency, FM 3120-3, About Face, Summary of the Principles of Art of War, Limited War, War of the Flea, A Study of Guerrilla Warfare Theory and Practice in the Midst of War and America's Mission to Southeast Asia, General David Petraeus, My Share of the Task, General Stanley McChrystal, Guerrilla Warfare by Mao Zedong, FM 324.2, Modern Warfare, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, The Revolt in the Desert, The Ugly American Victory at Any Cost, Fiasco, Counterinsurgency Warfare Theory and Practice, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, Countering Insurgency Lessons from Malaya and Vietnam, and a whole pile of other ones that I've read from cover to cover some numerous times of what this is. And I know I just ran through that list extremely fast, but I just kind of want to point out that it's insurgency is a little bit more intellectual than a bayonet charge. And I'll tell you over and over again, your guns are your most worthless piece of equipment. So, I still have the phones open here at 712-432-0900, and the room number is 957-464 and the pound sign. And to unmute your microphone, you can push *6. And if you'd like to ask questions, clarifications, concerns, observations, I'd like to hear what you have to say. And I know that when I'm doing these presentations that a lot of other people aren't, that, and then I come along and say, let's do an after-action review on this and find out why the Patriot movement ever seems to go anywhere. And then instead of listening to what is being said, then the usual detractors come in and say, well, don't have anything to do with that guy Mike. All he does is cause friction and division and infighting. He doesn't this, he doesn't that. He's not a team player. I am a team player. I'm just concerned that people seem to keep doing these same things over and over again and expecting a different result and getting people killed and thrown in prison forever and ever. And so obviously, by doing the same thing over and over again from at least Ruby Ridge forward up to the present day, doesn't really seem to, change anything. So if you have anything to say, 952-432-0900. The room number is 957-464, the pound sign, and to unmute your microphone, push star 6. This first news item is from cbp.gov/newsroom. The speaking of it's no fun being an illegal alien. 24th of April 2018, agents foil smuggling attempt, arrest gang member. Dateline Tucson, Arizona. Wilcox Station Border Patrol agents arrested a 40-year-old Douglas woman and four undocumented men, one identified as a felon, Sunday afternoon. Agents patrolling State Route 80 stopped a vehicle, conducted an immigration inspection, and identified four male passengers as Mexican nationals illegally present in the country. Agents arrested the driver along with the four men, ages 21 through 33, and seized the vehicle. During processing, agents conducted record checks on the Mexican nationals and discovered each man had previous immigration violations, and agents also identified one of the men as 20-year-old Pedro Mayo Gatica, a confirmed member of the Locotas street gang, who was deported earlier in the year following several felony convictions in California for sexual misconduct with a minor, as well as firearm charges and gang activities. The Douglas Mormon will remain in custody pending disposition on human smuggling charges, and the illegal aliens in the vehicle will be presented in federal court for immigration violations. Let's see, may also be presented for immigration violations. Proceedings could face additional charges as previously deported felon. Let's see, this is cbp.gov/newsroom. Agents arrest Sereno gang member in southeast Arizona. 24 April 2018, Tucson, Arizona. Border Patrol agents from the Brian A. Terry Station in Naco apprehended two illegal aliens Sunday afternoon and later identified one subject as a Sereno gang member. Agents arrested the two men shortly after they entered into the United States illegally near Naco and transported them to the Brian A. Terry Station for further processing. During processing, a records check identified one of the men, 33-year-old Pedacio Barragan Mendoza, as a Mexican national and active Sereno gang member. Records also show that Barragan has a history of immigration violations. Barragan will remain in custody pending immigration violations proceedings and could face additional charges for his affiliation with a violent street gang. The other man arrested, a Mexican national, will also be processed for immigration violations. The next article here is BorderlandBeat.com, dated 24 April 2018. The rapper QBA confesses to dissolving the three missing film students in acid. The singer, known as QBA Christian Omar N., is one of those involved in the murder of three students at the Audiovisual Media University who disappeared on March 19 in Poblana, Jalisco. The young man who identified himself as a rapper could have collaborated in the disappearance of the film students as well as the disappearance of their bodies by dissolving them in hydrochloric acid, according to the Attorney General of the state of Jalisco. According to the authorities cited in the newspaper Mural, the two detainees, Omar N. and Geraldo M., confessed that they had collaborated in the chemical process of the disappearances of the bodies in Ponal Estate, which was searched in past days. The students were confused by members of the New Generation Jalisco cartel with others from the opposing group as the Nuevo Plaza cartel. Omar N. had a YouTube channel that has 121,000 subscribers so far. His songs are about violence and drugs. Even in one of his videos shows a man's tied hands, his head covered and bloodied while trying to break free, and the India set fire. In total, the prosecutor's office is targeting eight people who at least participated in the disappearance of the three young people. Okay, I see we got about 7 minutes or so. Anybody out there like to say anything? Maybe nobody's listening or nobody wants to interrupt the flow of information. So I'll play the Jeopardy theme. Mm-hmm. cbp.gov/newsroom, convicted kidnapper arrested by U.S. Border Patrol agents, 24 April 2018, Tucson, Arizona. Tucson Station Border Patrol agents apprehended a 49-year-old Mexican man Saturday morning near Sasebo for re-entering the United States illegally following a previous conviction and deportation on kidnapping charges after agents arrested Flavio Sesma Maya and transported him to the Tucson Station for processing. They conducted a record check and discovered he was convicted in 2011 for felony kidnapping in Phoenix and was sentenced to more than 8 years in prison. Sesma is being held for immigration violations and faced prosecution for reentry of an aggravated felon. Nope. Nobody out there? Okay. This is a different one, insidecrime.org. We've discussed the FARC in the past. And by the way, I do have another show on Thursday and Fridays on the micro effect. It starts at the same time, but it's 2 hours each day, and we get to similar information of what's going on. Now, this, the Borderland Beat kind of just reports generally what's going on in Mexico, but sometimes if, like, the governor of Guerrero embezzled a bunch of money and skipped town and went to Italy and those were arrested, and then he gets extradited. So sometimes some of the news articles touch on other countries, but basically it focuses in on Mexico. Now, the Inside Crime, they cover everything from what's going on in the United States, what's going on in Mexico, Central and South America, and also that they do a kind of an analysis of not only just reporting the news, but what it means to the bigger picture. And that. Now, the FARC leader turns back on Congress, further jeopardizing peace. And that, again, is out of insidecrime.org, and it's dated 25 April 2018. The announcement by a FARC party heavyweight that he would not take a senatorial seat he has been offered as part of the 2016 peace agreement may further jeopardize an already shaky peace deal. Luciano Marin Arago, who still uses his nom de guerre, Arvin Marquez, and is currently the number two of the Common Alternative Revolutionary Force, the Fuerza Alternativa Revolutionary del Común, the FARC political party, announced during an April 24th interview with Channel One that he would renounce the seat he was offered in the Senate. A former high-ranking member of the now largely demobilized Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, Marquez has been chosen by the FARC political party to take one of the 10 congressional seats, 5 in the House of Representatives and 5 in the Senate, reserved to demobilized guerrilla fighters, as agreed under the 2016 peace accords. Okay. Nobody out there. Maybe it's too early on a Monday. Nobody wants to say anything. Borderlandbeat.com, 26 April 2018. CDN executes member of CDS in Durango. They have returned to heat the plaza. The Cartel de Noreste, who used to be Los Zetas in Nuevo León, who were led by Roberto Lozcano Lozcano, known as LZ-40 and LZ-42, today have returned to the Laguna in Durango to dispute the plaza with the Sinaloa cartel. In Laguna, people from CDN murdered Gabino Ortiz and Omar Moreno, who were Sinaloa cartel operatives in the Laguna region, and operated a horse stud farm with large betting to money laundering, and in the outskirts of the town in Durango, close to Gomez Placio, Durango. This is where in 2007 El Lesca kidnapped the anti-kidnapping police chief as part of a plan to visit extreme violence against the Sinaloa cartel. Now, while Epoch Violenta is not a mainstream news outlet, they do have most articles that are run by the main news outlets and have shown to be accurate with the lack of information coming from Chohula. Epoch is one of the most useful sites for news. This is usually that CDN would be pushing out into CDS territory. The victims were identified outside of the Denny's restaurant, according to reports of the police authorities, and the dead person was identified as Gabino Ortiz, who had gunshot wounds in the head of approximately 40 years old, originally from Bermejillo, Durango, and nephew of the ex-president of the community. All right. I only got just a couple minutes if anybody'd like to come up and say anything. Your mind is your primary weapon. And I know that I come along and everybody's been saying this for all these years. And then I come along waving my hands and going, I think you guys need to slow down a little bit and think about this and put this into perspective, a historical perspective. Why is it the insurgency? Everybody goes, well, we can't go up against these people. We don't have nuclear aircraft carriers and submarines and bombers and fighters and infantry and this and that. Well, it appears to me the insurgents over in Iraq and Afghanistan doing a pretty good job. So all has to do with planning and organization and understanding the basic principles of insurgency. Because your guns are your most worthless piece of equipment. Your mind is your primary weapon. In any type of warfare, most of the time you're going to be using your rifle or your pistol or your bazooka is only going to be maybe 2 or 3% of the time, maybe even 5%. But I noticed that a lot of the people, all they want to do is get their gear, go out to their camp or their training site, walk around a little bit, and then shoot holes in pieces of paper and call that training, endlessly expending a large quantities of ammunition at targets that can't shoot back. Because there's a lot more to this about the education, the strategy, the tactics, the training, the leadership, the planning, the intelligence preparation of the battlefield, the financing, the field sanitation, the organization, the security, the communications, the medical, and then doing an honest after-action review of about what we've done right, what we've done wrong, and how we can prevent these mistakes from happening over and over again. Because your mind is your primary weapon. Well, I see we're kind of up at the top of the hour now, and I'd like to thank you for being with me today. And next week, we'll continue to take calls, 712-432-0900. The room number is 957-464 in the pound sign, and *6 to unmute you. We can join together with the band. We can either hang together or we can hang separately.